They want to talk, and they're all, and they're really focused in on the industrial killing of the intentional industrial killing of civilians by the Germans during the war. Well, all this stuff, I wasn't interested in that with respect to this talk. And so anyway, these lady reporters, they really made me understand that I was talking to an audience that I didn't really realize, I didn't understand who my audience was. The very next day, I had to speak at Berkeley. Berkeley was, it's like I'd never been there. I got there, one, it was, oh, by the way, it was, I was there during Passover. So all my interesting Jewish friends, they weren't there. Plus, it was the one-year anniversary of a great anti-war protest in Oakland, I think. And so all the interesting people who were interested in controversial subjects were all up in Oakland or home doing Seder or whatever they do, you know? So, however, I'd learned a little bit and I'd changed the talk a little bit and I'd left and I realized that I had to leave out one of my favorite stories. I was talking about the issue of belief. One of the things I did, by the way, I thought it was kind of interesting, is I asked at San Jose, I didn't, but at Berkeley I did. I asked, I suppose that all of you people believe in the gas chamber stories. I mean, that would be normal. It wouldn't be unusual for you. And I said, if there's anyone here who does not believe in the gas chamber story, would you please raise your hand? Well, no hands went up. And I said, okay, well, that's what I expect. Now, how many of you here have read Serge Sion, Carlo Montaigne, Jürgen Graf, Robert Foresson, Arthur Butz? Well, nobody had read anything. And so I tried to make this point to them that they are absolutely certain in their beliefs that the gas chambers existed, but they haven't read any of the literature that criticizes the Orthodox literature. Now, they've read all this stuff, and then here's this other body of literature that's critical of it. They haven't read that. What you do is you read both, you put them together, and you separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, we all know that. That's what everybody does. And in other areas of academia, that would even be called a scientific principle, I think. So correct me if I'm wrong. Okay? Yeah. I went back to Baja. I live in Mexico now. Came back up because I had to do Chico this last week. Well, I decided that I was giving the wrong talk. And one of the reasons I decided I was giving the wrong talk was that the criticisms I was getting from the student journalists at San Jose, and some remarks that were made to me by a couple revisionists who attended the Berkeley affair, which were Andrew Allen and Heinz Bartisch. And I put a different angle on. I'm not going to do the whole talk. I can't do the whole talk that I did for them, okay? But what I wanted to do is I wanted to set forth three or four ideas that students might be interested in. It might cause them to think about things or to have questions about things. And I wanted to make it as simple as possible and to set it up in a way that it could not really be debated. And what I did is every one of them had this little essay that was written by Cole and I. And I pointed out to them that if you take this essay to Germany and you try to distribute it, you risk being prosecuted and imprisoned for up to 5 years. You know, if you take it to France, the same thing. You risk being prosecuted and imprisoned up to 5 years and a 300,000 French franc fine. And it's kind of interesting is that the French law is kind of interesting because you cannot challenge any of the judgments that were made at Nuremberg or other war crimes trials. That was more than half a century ago. And this was a court that was run under the auspices of Democrats and Republicans for Truman. and loyal Communist Party members under Joseph Stalin. And so I asked the kids, if you can't believe what Republicans and Democrats tell you, and you can't believe what communist factotums serving Joseph Stalin tell you, who can you believe? You know? And I think, I don't think they got it. I don't think they got it. Anyway, similar laws to them. I told them where they could get this information. It's on the website of the Jewish Policy Review. It's a British outfit. They support the criminalization of Holocaust studies, of Holocaust arguments, the public expression of Holocaust arguments. But nevertheless, they have a lot of interesting stuff on the site as well. So I asked them, what's going on? Not only that, but at Hofstra University in 1988, law has already been written that criminalizes, that will criminalize Holocaust revisionism in America if the law passes and sustains an appeal to the Supreme Court. It will then be illegal. This meeting will be illegal by law if that comes to fruition. A book published, I give some history of that in here. The book was published by Greenwood Press and by the lawyers who masterminded the conference, and they're simply waiting for the right court to see if they can't get it passed. So the criminalization of Holocaust studies in Europe does two things. One, of course, it corrupts intellectual life in Western culture, and two, it stops the study of revisionist arguments in Europe because it becomes a criminal offense in most cases. I wanted to try and tie this in to the weapons of mass destruction issue, which everyone here has thought about. But more than a half century before the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction fraud, there was the German weapons of mass destruction fraud, the alleged gas chambers of the National Socialists. Just like the Iraqi WMDs have not been found, the German WMDs have never been shown to exist in the first place. The photographs of identifying buildings and vans housing Iraqi WMDs exhibited at the United Nations by the Bush administration and viewed all over the world via television turned out to be arguably fraudulent. More than a half a century earlier, the photographs of buildings and vans housing German WMDs, the alleged gas chambers and gas vans, and since viewed by millions of people in thousands of books and newspapers, turn out to have been photographs of something else. In Iraq, buildings were photographed where Iraqi WMDs were being stored or invented or assembled or manufactured. The buildings are still there. The U.S. ran down the trucks, some of the trucks. In Germany, Poland, Austria, buildings that were photographed as gas chambers are still there. They're tourist attractions. It's just not been demonstrated that they were used to intentionally kill millions of people. On the American side, Republicans and Democrats were responsible for both frauds. Bush did it largely on his own. He got bad advice from Tenet and a few other people. Harry Truman got bad advice as well, primarily from the Stalinists. If you want to find out what part this Stalin played in inventing the gas chamber story, and I gave them this reference, you can begin with a book by Carlos Porter, The Holocaust Made in Russia. Half a century ago, the first WMD fraud was used as a moral justification for Democrats and Republicans in league with Zionists to create a Jewish state occupied by Palestinians. Other than the WMD story, there was no other moral justification. Because the National Socialists had genocided the Jews of Europe using weapons of mass destruction, those Jews had the right to invade Palestine, conquer the people who were living there, and take for themselves the land they wanted. It was their moral right because they'd been exterminated. A half century later, the possession of weapons of mass destruction by the Iraqi administration was the moral justification for Republicans and Democrats to initiate a preemptive war against a nation that had done us no harm and was not an imminent danger to America, but was to Israel. So Israel then benefited from the second WMD fraud just as it had the first. And I finished this little section with them, and I think that they were rather quiet during that. The audience seemed to be rather quiet during this short segment. And I ended it by saying, I think that we can safely speculate that without the unfailing support of Republicans and Democrats to aid Israel in its colonization of Palestinian land, there'd be no 9/11. Well, that's no surprise for you guys. But we should simply note here that before Israel, America had no enemies in the Muslim world. Now, I don't know how many times college students have heard that little argument before, but I don't think very many times. And I'm talking to them, so I'm telling you, a lot of this is old stuff for you, but I'm telling them what I think some of the things that you might like to tell them. Some of them had studied the Holocaust at San Jose. And I said, listen, I understand that much of what I'm saying here goes against what you've been taught in college, but we have to take a look at the professorial class, you know? And the professorial class as a class, and there are always individual exceptions, but when the chips are down, the professorial class always goes with the state and against intellectual freedom. I don't know how many professors tell their students that. And I asked them, if this hasn't occurred to you before, just consider the behavior of the professorial class under Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Mao Zedong, even a Fidel Castro or a Pinochet. It's all the same. The professorial class always follows, as a class, it always follows the state line. And of course, Nuremberg was a state-operated process. There's not one significant segment of the professorial class in any Western country that's found it necessary to question the state line that guided National Socialist WMD fraud through Nuremberg and other war crimes court, and not one segment that attempts to stand up for intellectual freedom and free inquiry for revisionists. I thought this next section would just knock them over. I love this section, yeah. The one great ideal of American culture is intellectual freedom. This includes a free press, free inquiry, free expression, free speech, the whole enchilada, no? Academics, actually, they use a beautiful image to represent intellectual freedom. They call it light of day. It's a beautiful image. I think it probably comes from Matthew, where he wrote, the sun shines on the good and the bad alike. The interesting part of the great beauty of intellectual freedom, of the light of day, is that it's empty. And we're speaking with a literary image here. We're not speaking as scientists, okay? So I know a scientist, he'll say, well, light has content. But as a literary or philosophical image, light has no content. And this is why, that's the great beauty of light, is its emptiness. It's flawless. It has no opinions. It has no prejudices. It favors no one. It's perfect. It's empty. The purpose of light is simply to illuminate what's there. When you illuminate what's there, and in a free society, everybody has the right to look and to judge what's there according to their own understanding. It can't really work any other way. The wonderful thing about light is that it has no desire. You don't use light. Well, light has no desire. Everyone who looks at what's there through light has some desire, but light itself has no desire. It's flawless. Yeah. Light doesn't care about you. You know, it's not sentimental. Light has only the function to reveal what's there. Those who want to control access to light want to control what you think. Those who turn a historical issue into a taboo subject fear light. Those who want to criminalize open debate fear light. And they fear what's there. And they fear what light will reveal. I think that's good for a college kid to hear. I want. Do you hear all that stuff? That's my Tic Tacs. No. Okay. 15 minutes. Deborah Lipstadt. She's my hero. I'm sure she must be yours too. In her much praised Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, it's one of the books that every Holocaust studies professor recommends to his students. This book is widely accepted on campus. In the spirit of full disclosure, one of the chapters addresses my work on campus, a 26-page chapter. And in that chapter, she gives her view of light, and it is this, quote, "It's naive to believe that the light of day can dispel lies, especially when they play on familiar stereotypes. Victims of racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, and a host of other prejudices know of light's limited ability to discredit falsehood," close quote. So my point with the students is to ask them, what will dispel lies and discredit falsehood? Darkness? You have a choice. You have light, or you have what the professors give you. As a matter of fact, how many victims of racism, sexism, anti-Semitism speak out against light in favor of suppression and censorship? None that I know of. They all want an open hearing and to be able to tell their point of view. So, but on American campuses, well, here's what I have. Oh, by the way, this is kind of interesting. How many victims of racism, sexism, and anti-Semitism speak against light and in favor of suppression and censorship? Now, I'm telling this to student audiences who know nothing about us. I wonder how Jews felt about light in pre-war Nazi Germany. Early on, the National Socialists moved against Jews in the arts, against Jews in publishing, against Jews in the universities, all places where traditionally light is so highly valued. The Nazis had views about light in the 1930s, it would appear, that are quite similar to those of many professors today. That is, light for them and darkness for everyone else. Aside from that, Lipstadt is just wrong. No better case for light, and remember, I'm speaking to a college audience here. There's no better case for light, that is, for intellectual freedom and for the right to dissent, without which there is no intellectual freedom, can be made with regard to America than the history of slavery in this country. Imagine what the right to dissent, to intellectual freedom, would have meant to Africans who were brought to our country as slaves for more than two centuries, month after month. Imagine as they came down the gangplank one by one, and this black guy would put his foot on the earth, and at that moment, entering the United States of America, he was given the rights of our First Amendment. He was given the right to dissent. That is, the right of intellectual freedom. He would be given the rights instantly to dissent, the right of free speech and free expression. It's very likely he would have asked, I think I'll go back. I don't want to live this way. But we're not going to know because, of course, we've been saddled with this problem now for 300 years because we betrayed the ideals of our own culture, which is we have the right to think, just like Condoleezza Rice says. We're supposed to have the right to think. If they had been allowed the right to think and to express dissent, the history of America would be very different than it is now. I got into the issue of taboo because intellectual freedom is not criminalized in America broadly, but it's taboo. And I've told this story before. I hope I haven't told it to too many of you. But when I was a bookseller on Hollywood Boulevard in 1960, oh, and Harvey mentioned this, I was selling, Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer had been published. I had received this book in an illegal copy. I'd been working, earlier, when I was younger, I was working in an art gallery in New York City. Samuel Loveman, an old bookman, had a rare bookshop in the back. He specialized in anti-Semitism and a little pornography, I think. And he used to bring in books from the Obelisk Press in Paris. And they published Miller, and they published a lot of writers that were banned in America at that time because they were obscene in the eyes of Christians. And they were obscene. So anyway, he gave me one of these books. I read Tropic of Cancer, and I loved the book. I loved this guy. I mean, he became one of my models as a writer. So a couple years later, I'm selling books on Hollywood Boulevard. I had my own store, Barney Rossett in New York. Samuel Loveman was a Jew. Barney Rossett's a Jew. He publishes Tropic of Cancer. I have this big display in my window, and it's my best-selling book. Not only do I love this book, it turns out that it's the best-selling book I have. And after a couple weeks, a guy comes in I used to know because he was on the force with me. He was on the sheriff's department with me. I helped train him. Now he's a sergeant. He came in and he said, listen, somebody's going to be on Hollywood Boulevard is going to be arrested for selling Tropic of Cancer. He said, you better get it out of there. And I said, well, okay. And so I went in to take the book out, and it was a big display, and I didn't have the heart. So the next morning, I walked up and down Hollywood Boulevard, and I'm looking in all the bookstore windows. It was a bookstore row, Hollywood Boulevard at that time. And all the booksellers had taken their book out the window, including Pickwick Books, which was run by Louis Epstein. It was the biggest bookstore on the boulevard. And as I was walking in to check to see if he had it on display anywhere, I found one of his clerks selling it from under the counter. See, Louis knew how to do these things. He was a professional. So anyway, I go back to my store, and make a long story short, I go in the store window three times. I go in the store window three times to take Tropic of Cancer out, and I can't bring myself to do it because I love the book, I love Henry Miller. And I didn't do it on First Amendment principles. I did it because I loved the guy, and I didn't want to betray him. So they arrested me and took me to jail and prosecuted me. And it was 5 weeks, the longest civil trial in Los Angeles up to that time, 1961. And they convicted me of selling a book banned by the U.S. government, essentially because it disrupted community standards. That was the guiding line of the thing. So it had bad words in it. I'm telling this story to the students, and I'm emphasizing, when I'm telling them, I go through a big dramatic scene about, oh, no, wait a minute. Oh, gosh. Jesus. That had to do with the issue of taboo. And I'm going to end on time, okay? Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. I'm interested in the concept of the unique monstrosity of the Germans. Every student I spoke to that I'm aware of, and every professor that I spoke to who said anything to me or who demonstrated against me, by the way, at Chico State, there were more professors outside demonstrating against my talk than were in the talk listening to me. And they didn't come in on principle because how could they listen to me on principle, you know? And so I wanted the audience to understand that the unique monstrosity of the Germans serves a real purpose. You know, you probably already understand that. But it's been used in a very peculiar way. It's odd that it's being used for so long. It's used essentially to make credible the idea that World War II was a good war, that it was a moral war. And the unique monstrosity of the Germans gives moral purpose to all those who benefited by their defeat. We have to be clear, though, the students have to be clear about what the fundamental charge against the Germans is. It isn't a bunch of details here and there, you know, soap and lampshades and brain-bashing, pedal-driven brain-bashing machines and all this stuff. The fundamental charge against the Germans is this: they intentionally killed civilians. It doesn't matter how they did them, what weapons were used. That's the primary story if you want to talk about it. The Germans intentionally killed civilians, the National Socialists. If you believe the gas chamber stories are baloney, well, Germans intentionally killed civilians in other ways. They shot them for this and that and so forth. But here's the thing is, during World War II, Democrats and Republicans intentionally burned alive, we all know this, scores of thousands of babies and children and women and old folk. And the terrible destructions of the firestorms in Hamburg and Dresden are only two examples. They intentionally killed civilians. In short, Democrats and Republicans did exactly what they accuse National Socialists of having done, except no one contradicts them. Everyone knows Democrats and Republicans did that. During World War II, Democrats and Republicans vaporized the entire civilian populations of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Nobody's trying to argue the point. Everybody believes it. No, we don't have to censor the people who are questioning the atomic bombing by Republicans and Democrats of Nagasaki. We know they did it. And if there's anyone here that doesn't, you know, thinks they didn't do it, you can write a paper and get it published. And you can probably even get it published in Europe. Who knows? We never discuss. We all know, and students know, what Republicans and Democrats did. But they don't really take it seriously. It's too common for them. It doesn't matter to them. It doesn't matter to them that the culture is consistently talking about the unique monstrosity of the Germans. And yet here we are, Republicans and Democrats, we do the same thing as the National Socialists. In fact, I asked the students, if the fundamental charge against the National Socialists were that they intentionally killed civilians, what did they do that Republicans and Democrats did not do? You know? There was probably not, there's probably not two National Socialists in all of Chico, but it's swimming with Republicans and Democrats. You're up to your chin in Republicans and Democrats, and it doesn't matter to you. So it's not the killing, it's something else. There's something else going on there, and you ought to think about it. And I end with something. I almost end with something that you all know about, and for them is really, I think, is rather stunning, because they sat there in all three instances, they sat there in just silence for a moment. Nobody said anything. The criminalization of Holocaust revisionism in Europe and the taboo against revisionist studies in America has corrupted our culture in very deep ways. I'll end this talk with a few words by Elie Wiesel, Holocaust survivor, Nobel Peace Prize recipient, and all-around famous guy in our universities. You've all heard this. Quote, every Jew somewhere in his being should set apart a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the German personifies and for what persists in the German. And I reference the quote. And I say that you may not see the relevance of this statement if you're hearing it for the first time, but he's talking about a people. He's not talking about a political party. He's talking about what they personify and what persists in their character, which could be a cultural description, but becomes very, it's certainly an ethnic description, becomes very close to a racial to a racialist description. What they personify and for what persists in their character. Not National Socialist Germans. It's my experience, I always have to explain this to people the first time they hear it. And then I'll say to the students, in order to explain how the myth of the unique monstrosity of the Germans has puddled our hearts with something filthy that we really need to take a look at, I'll just change one statement in the word, just one word in the statement, just one word. Every Palestinian, somewhere in his being, should set apart a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the Jew personifies and for what persists in the Jew. And then I have two sentences here, and I ask the kids, I say, it reads kind of ugly, doesn't it? Yeah. In America, administered by Republicans and Democrats, the mass murderers of Japanese and Germans, we can talk that way about Germans because Germans are uniquely monstrous. They used weapons of mass destruction to intentionally kill civilians. Anyone who doubts that assertion should keep it to himself or be willing, in the end, to risk imprisonment. And with that, then I ask for questions from the audience, and each time there's been a dead silence for two or three minutes, for one or two minutes, and then a hand will go up here and a hand will go up there, and we'll have a little back and forth. And I'm still working on this thing, but the thing is, I think that we have to go out, and I feel like I have to go out onto campus and talk to kids and get young people involved in this, what is a very simple issue. You don't have to be an expert on the chemistry of Zyklon B to argue for intellectual freedom in the light of day. Thanks.